Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Are you over-preparing for your big conversations? Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Cruz. Welcome to the LeadX Show, where we help you to stand out and to get ahead. Friendly reminder, at LeadX, we're on a mission over the next 10 years to catalyze 100 million leaders. One way we do that is by offering free world-class training to anyone, anywhere, at any time. Tell all the managers in your company to visit leadx.org to check out our free course of the day. Friends, some days it's good to be me. Now, I was very lucky. I was able to spend quite a bit of time, actually, with the great actor, writer, director, Alan Alda. He was everything I was expecting him and hoping he would be. So gracious, so kind, so down to earth, very funny. You know, if you're anywhere close to my age, then you know Alan Alda from his iconic role as Hawkeye Pierce in the TV show MASH, you know, like one of the most successful TV shows of all time. Now, younger listeners out there, or maybe listeners from around the world, maybe you know him more from his recent series, you know, where he acted on The West Wing. He's won 7 Emmy Awards, 3 Tony nominations. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his role as Senator Owen Brewster in the movie The Aviator. And if you're wondering, like, why is Alan Alda a guest on the LeadX Show? Like, you know, what does he have to do with leadership and career and all that? Well, Alda also hosted the PBS series Scientific American Frontiers for 11 years. And he also founded the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science over at Stony Brook University. His new book is called If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. Now, I had a chance to talk to Alan Alda in his conference room in New York City. I did a horrible job of recording it on my little digital recorder, but thankfully, I've got an awesome audio engineer, Katrina Faust. She punched it up. She at least made it passable. And we cover so much ground, and because it's Alan Alda, this is going to be a two-parter. In this first part today, Alan Alda shares his failure story, which actually is a perfect lesson in giving feedback as a boss, how you can actually over-prepare for a conversation or an interview, and we hear about how he's trained over 8,000 scientists in how to communicate better with methods of improv and storytelling. So let's get right into the interview with Alan Alda. Alan, it's a real pleasure. Welcome to the LeadX Show.
Thank you. This is going to be fun.
Now, I'm looking forward to talking to you about your new book in just a minute, but we have a tradition on the LeadX Show. I ask all of our guests the same first question, and it's tell me a story about a time when you failed at something and what did you learn from it? Because selfishly, I want to learn from your failure.
Well, I think you have something to learn from this. I certainly did, and it came to mind as soon as you asked me the question. I was directing a movie, and on the first or second shot that I set up, early in the first day, I put the actors in front of the camera where I wanted them to be for the shot. It was just a couple of lines of dialogue, but I had them placed at an unusual angle, because it was the way I saw it fitting into the way I was going to cut the movie. And I set it up, set up the size of the framing of the shot with the operator of the camera. And then I went away to work on the next shot while they lit the scene. That took about a half an hour. I came back. The actors were standing in a completely different position. And I said to the operator, What happened to what I set up? He said, I fixed it for you. I fixed it for you. And I said, no, but see, I set it up that way because that's how I want it. And I made a mistake in the next moment. I had already taken a half an hour for him to fix things. It would take another half hour to relight it the way I wanted to do it. And I didn't want to start my first day behind schedule. And I might have said something gentle like, please don't change it when I do. I don't even know if I said that. But I fixed it a little bit. I made it a little bit more the way I wanted it and carried on with it. That was a signal to him that I didn't realize I was giving him. Mm-hmm. That when I gave a direction, that was the direction we were going to go in. And if he was going to change it, he had to ask permission. And he couldn't assume that he knew more about what was needed than I did, because you got to have one person at the top who knows what all the data is, who knows what all the problems are, and has to decide what gets priority and the direction you're going to go in. I do want feedback from other people, and I would have been happy to hear his complaint. He didn't even complain. He didn't even say, this is such a strange angle you're shooting at. Are you sure you want this? And I would have said, yeah, and told him why, and not taken too much time doing that, because you don't want to discuss every move you make. But what makes it a good story, I think, about a failure is that he continued to do this for the next 6 weeks. And I kept trying to explain to him, but by the time we got to 6 weeks, I just said, I got to get somebody else here. I have to replace him. Now, by now, he was furious at me for replacing him. What I should have said in the beginning was, not only please don't do that again, but if you do it again, we're going to have to think about whether or not you're the right person for the job. I should have really been clear what was at stake.
Giving that feedback earlier and more specifically about the repercussions.
Right. Really frank and clear, not angry, not upset, but I can't work that way. We can't make the picture that way. And let it be his choice. And if he did it again once or twice, then that would be it.
Right.
Which would have occurred within the first 2 days. And I wouldn't have to keep us all waiting 6 weeks. And it slowed us down. I was worried about time. The constant discussions I had to have with him because he felt he had the right to challenge everything I said wasn't good. It wasn't good for me, and it wasn't good for him, because he thought for 6 weeks that this was the way we were going to work. No matter how I tried to dissuade him, I could have been much more frank about what was at stake.
Why do you think you didn't have that conversation earlier? Were you trying to be nice?
I wasn't trying to be nice. I think I was expecting more professionalism.
He would have got the hint the first time.
If probably, as I look back on it, he might have thought, oh, this guy doesn't really know what he's doing. I had already directed 4 or 5 movies, so I knew what I was doing, and dozens of television shows. I really knew what I was doing. But he might have come in thinking, he doesn't really know. He needs my help. And no matter what he says, I'm going to give it to him. You got to be able to read those signals. I wasn't good at reading those signals at that time. You know, since then, I've done a lot of work in communication, and it's based on reading signals from the other person, the person you're trying to communicate with. I feel you have to do more listening when you're trying to communicate than you do when you're being communicated with. Sounds odd, but I think that's helpful, because if I wanted him really to understand, I would have been a little bit clearer about the clues I was getting from him that he didn't, I think now, probably didn't really respect my position.
Right.
And I expected him to respect it. I didn't think I had to discuss it with
him. You weren't looking for those clues that maybe he wasn't. You didn't think.
Right? Yeah.
Right. Now, this, it's interesting that your failure story is a communication story. Your new book, again, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. And you start by talking about another failure communication story back when you started to host Scientific American Frontiers back in 1993, right?
Yeah, I thought I was in a good position to interview scientists on the program because I was so interested and curious about science. And I had had training in improvisation, and I thought we would have enlightening conversations. And I still had a lot to learn, although I didn't know it. And I walked into the first interview and couldn't think of what to say and started telling him things about his work that I assumed were true. I just made assumptions. Oh, look, you did all this solar panel stuff with parts off the shelf. What made me think they were parts off the shelf? I don't know where I got that idea. And he looked a little offended. He said, they're not off the shelf, we made them. And then I tried to get familiar with his work and put my hand casually on his solar panel, and I could see pain come across his face. He said, please don't touch it, you're liable to ruin it.
Oh, jeez.
And the third mistake I made was I wasn't asking him questions based on what he was telling me. I wasn't really listening to what he was saying and responding with my curiosity. Tell me more about that. I don't get that. I don't understand what you mean. I was even afraid to say, I don't know what you mean, which is one of the most valuable things you can say in any conversation. You know, what do you mean by that? Because people mean different things by the same English words. And that's before you get into jargon.
Right.
When sometimes a piece of jargon means two different things in two different fields, then you're really in trouble. But even if it just means something special in one field, you better admit you don't know it. If you don't know what it means, you better admit it, because you can travel a long path misunderstanding and be headed towards something else. You won't make the sale. You won't get the cooperation. The team won't function. All kinds of things will go wrong.
Well, and this was this hit me personally because of the interviews I do for LeadX and the training work we do. Because you're saying you have a unique definition of what it means to really be listening. Most company training programs out there will teach active listening.
Yeah.
And they focus on eye contact, body language, and they'll teach you to parrot back the thing that someone has said to you.
Yeah.
But you have something very unique. You say real listening, you have to be willing to let the other person change you.
Yeah, and I know that sounds radical. And I'll tell you where I got it from, so we'll put it in perspective. From my experience acting on the stage and in movies, I don't say my next line in a scene because it's written in the script or because I've memorized it and that I know it comes after your line. I say the next line because you make me say it. I'm responsive to you. I let you change me. I'm in one state of mind. And then you start talking or you start behaving in a certain way, and it makes something happen to me. And that's why I say the next line, and that's why I say it the way I say it. That notion I began to realize in board meetings and sales meetings even, where I wanted to communicate something to somebody else, but in the process, I realized I needed to listen to them. And instead of showing them I was listening, like simply repeating what they said to me, which, by the way, if you do in a clumsy way, it makes you the most annoying person in the room. You know, if it looks mechanical, it's terrible. But it ought to be to make sure you know what the person's talking about. So, do I have this right? Is this what you mean? That kind of thing. Where you, if you're really trying to make a connection with the other person and you're really dedicated to the idea that whatever the other person is saying may be so valuable that it can have a positive effect on you, then you really want to know what they mean by what they're saying. And you're demonstrating in an active listening way that you heard them is more than just a form, more than a formality. Mm-hmm. It's actually reinforcing the connection you have by wanting to really know you're on the same wavelength with them. And if you're slightly off the wavelength, what a victory to know that. what a wonderful thing to say, oh, I thought you meant the other thing. I thought this is great. You know, I see what you mean now. Just really seeing what the other person means and being open to the idea that even if it's based on an idea you don't agree with, even strongly don't agree with, there may be something under that, some impulse under it that's a positive impulse as far as you're concerned, and that could really help you. Not to act like it helps you. It's not a phony interaction. It's to really find a connection with the other person that shows the respect for the other person, that they're worth listening to. And it's not a show. It's not acting.
It's not acting.
Yeah. And good acting is not acting.
Good acting.
I mean, the best acting comes when acting drops away and an authentic experience takes place.
Now, I, again, really lit up. You said that the episodes of Scientific American Frontiers, you got better when you stopped over-preparing, when you stopped preparing questions.
Yeah, in the beginning, I thought it was my duty to read every paper I could find by the scientists. And the mistake was that in a couple of days, I couldn't know what that scientist knows after 30 years of work. What I could know was what I thought his work added up to after 30 years, which was almost invariably wrong. My assumptions were my enemy. Instead of going in and asking this scientist what he or she had dedicated themselves to, and to tell me in terms I could understand, I assumed things in the beginning. I thought I was going in prepared. I was really going in prepared for trouble, because when I started to really read their faces while we were talking, I would see this just flicker of panic come across their face when I would ask a question that assumed something about their work that wasn't true. And that's hard for them, because what are they going to say? They're the guy interviewing them in the middle of a broadcast or in the middle of a taping. Well, you don't really understand this. It's not, you're way off from what I'm trying to do. So you're putting him in a box. He couldn't really object, and he couldn't really answer the question because it assumed something wrong. When I stopped doing all of that over-preparation, I made sure I was prepared in the sense that I had a general idea of what the work was about. Then my ignorance was my ally, because ignorance with curiosity is wonderful. Ignorance without curiosity, not so good.
Well, I was wondering if there was middle ground, because here's where I struggled. When I read this idea of going into an interview without questions, made me think about the best podcast episodes I've ever had, where the emails come in from listeners saying, wow, that was the best one. It's when I've always gone off script. Something funny happened.
There you have it. But it doesn't mean you don't have to have guideposts.
Well, I was going to say, so you enlightened me, and what did I do? I went and bought and read every book you've ever written. I went and watched every interview you've done in the last 2 years, and I'm here with 5 questions in front of me. So why is it so hard?
Well, you mean you shouldn't have done all the work?
Don't you think? If I'd listened to your advice, I would have said I'm going to come in here naive.
Well, but the 5 questions are way fewer than what most people come in with. I was admiring the fact that you had your notebook open, and you just had like a couple of sentences down there. Like, now I see it's 5. But look how much conversation we can get out of just having a few guideposts. The thing is, if you're doing something in real time,
right. For
instance, I've interviewed scientists a lot in front of an audience, a large audience, and we only have 45 minutes or an hour. Well, if it's totally a conversation that just goes anywhere it wants to go, it might be entertaining, but it might not achieve what the scientists hoped to achieve,
right,
which was to sell his book.
Right. You know?
Although I've had scientists who say, forget the book, let's just have fun. And they know they'll get interesting and pertinent points out along the way. But I use, a little guideline sometimes if it's live. But don't forget, Scientific American Frontiers was shot on tape, and we had an hour or 2 hours of material that would be cut down to 2 or 3 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes. So the editor made a coherent conversation out of it.
Right, right.
But the value of my being able to just have an open-ended conversation was the scientists and I were drawn into each other's orbit. We were really connected. And the real person came out of the scientist. If the scientist had a funny sense of humor, that blossomed.
Right.
If they had a lot of ambition that they wouldn't ordinarily show, that showed. And it was a human element. The connection, the human connection, really made for listenable stuff. And I think that's what you're telling me, why people listen to your podcast and respond to it when it goes conversational.
Right. I think that's right. But you also found that, so you changed your approach to communication as the host of that show, but you also discovered that scientists could use some help communicating their ideas.
Well, it was more like this. It's a lot like that, but it had this extra element in it. The conversations almost always went really well. So it wasn't that I saw scientists couldn't communicate. It was that I saw, although scientists have a reputation for not communicating in a personal way, telling stories and being emotional, although they have that reputation, when we would talk, you didn't see that happen much because we had this human dynamic connection. So I thought, wouldn't it be good if we could train scientists to have that without somebody like me standing next to them, to have them, give them the opportunity to get used to making this personal connection in a workshop. And then when they turned to the audience, they would have that ability to look them in the eye and talk to them in a personal tone, not look over their heads because they're nervous and don't want to actually be seen by people. The worry, how am I doing, is such an enemy to real connection and real communication. How you're doing is how you're doing. That's just reality, regardless of whether you know it or not. But connecting is so much more fun than worrying how you're doing, and it leads to so many better results.
And you started to teach them. At first, you were experimenting about, could some of the improv training that you've had and many actors have help with this connection, right?
Yeah. That's all I wanted from it. I wasn't looking to make scientists or medical professionals into comedians. It's not that kind of improvising.
Right.
It's improvising exercises whose only objective or whose main objective is to help you connect with the other person. And that turns out to be, I think, the reason why it's so useful, not only in communicating science and medicine, but in communicating in the workplace.
Right.
Because the connection with the other person helps you work better together, helps you understand. I mean, here you are. You've been drawn into this company for reasons that have nothing to do with your personal chemistry.
Right.
In a movie, the leading man and leading woman are put together partly because people think they'll have good chemistry together. I don't think people are hired that way, mostly.
I don't think so either.
So if you can do something to improve that chemistry, won't things work more smoothly? Won't that be the grease in the gears? And I think it is. And the way we started to find that out was from scientists who started to say to us, not only do I communicate better with an audience, the teamwork in my lab is so much better. Because people are listening to one another. People are openly communicating.
And you ended up formalizing the program, the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook.
Yeah.
It started how many years ago?
8 years ago. And since then, we've had in workshops over 8,000 scientists and doctors.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. And we're brought back to places. We've also trained in corporations like NASA. It's not a corporation, but
yeah.
I mean, places that aren't universities.
Yeah.
Mostly universities, but NASA, the National Academy of Sciences, IBM. IBM had a problem that many corporations have where there's some science in the corporation. They had scientists who needed to communicate their science to the business people who ran the business, And before it could be communicated to a clientele or to customers, the people who ran the business had to know that they had something valuable to sell. And the scientists were coming in with their technical knowledge, and they only had 15 minutes to explain it. So you got to be really sharp about the way you talk about what you're talking about. And I think that's probably a model that we're going to be called in to help work on more and more.
Friends, before we go, remember, at LeadX, we're on a mission to give free leadership training and professional development to everyone, anywhere, at any time. Visit leadx.org, that is, to check out our course of the day. Or visit leadx.org/Branson to download our free ebook, Richard Branson's 7 Secrets to Leadership. And please take one quick minute, go to leadx.org/subscribe to subscribe and leave a rating for this podcast, the LeadX Leadership Show. leadx.org/subscribe. Until next time, remember, you have incredible influence on those around you, your family, your team at work, your community. We all need you to lead mindfully. How will you lead today?